This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Plum Island is not open to just anyone because for years it's been the home of a federal animal disease center. But with plans to move the center's operations to Kansas, the federal government wants to sell the island to the highest bidder. But a coalition made up of civic and environmental groups from New York State and Connecticut have sued the government, hoping to stop such a sale. Coming up, we learn more about Plum Island, including what's at stake if the public land is sold to a private bidder. Amy Folk, historian for the town of Southold, New York, and co-author of a book about Plum Island called A World Unto Itself, will join us. We'll also get the latest on a controversial ordinance in the city of Hartford that has pro-life and pro-choice advocates weighing in. But first, the question heading into this past weekend was, would Christine Blasey Ford testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee? Blasey Ford has accused Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault when they were teenagers in Maryland. Her attorneys have been negotiating the terms of her testimony with Senate staff. It's been reported she will testify this Thursday. But now, another allegation has become public after a story in The New Yorker Sunday evening. This accusation comes from Deborah Ramirez, who says Kavanaugh exposed himself to her at a party when they were both students at Yale University. To talk more about this constantly changing story, joining us now is Anna North. She's senior reporter at Vox. Anna, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, we hope to have U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal joining us. He sits on the Senate Judiciary Committee. But Anna, let's just talk a little bit more about the latest regarding Ms. Blasey Ford and what has been agreed upon if she testifies on Thursday.
Right. So everything's a little in flux, obviously, at the moment with this new allegation. But over the weekend, Dr. Ford's lawyers and the Senate had agreed that Dr. Ford would testify on Thursday and that Kavanaugh would testify also. Certain things still remain to be worked out. I know, they were debating, for instance, whether Kavanaugh would be allowed to follow Dr. Ford, give testimony afterwards, which could potentially give him the last word. I think they were still trying to work that out. And of course, now everything is different and we'll see if the hearing, in fact, goes forward on Thursday at all.
Now, before, technically, this hearing was supposed to be today, and then there was a last-minute deadline on Saturday for Ms. Blasey Ford and her attorneys to agree to testify, and now it's Thursday. But let's talk more about just the concerns that have been expressed and the way she's been treated, including, there were calls from her attorneys that the FBI should first investigate before she even shows up before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
That's right. I mean, this has been a call from her attorneys, and Democrats in the Senate have been calling for this too. And it is, it's a complicated situation because if Ford is to testify, and Kavanaugh testifies, and the two of them are the only voices heard, then there's potential. Her lawyers feel for the American public really not to get the full story, and they would prefer an investigation that could talk to other witnesses, could talk to people privately, and really potentially uncover, they feel, more of the facts.
There have been a lot of talk about how this situation between Ms. Ford and Brett Kavanaugh, the case parallels events that happened back in 1991 when Anita Hill accused then Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment when they worked together. Can you talk about the similarities and the differences, Anna?
Absolutely. There are a lot of parallels here. It's really striking. Obviously, again, we have a woman coming forward to accuse a Supreme Court nominee of sexual misconduct. We also have hearings being reopened after they were initially closed. Unfortunately, we have seen Dr. Ford already receive some of the same kind of treatment that Anita Hill received. Both women received death threats after coming forward. Dr. Ford has actually had to leave her home because she feared for her safety. What I think we can potentially hope for is to see if the Me Too movement has changed anything. And if, in fact, Dr. Ford does go forward and testify on Thursday, we can look to see whether she's treated differently than the way that Anita Hill was treated. Famously, Hill was smeared in the press. She was called a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty. And then you know, during and after the hearing, she wasn't necessarily treated with the most respect either. And so we can really look to see, you know, has the movement changed the way that someone is received by both the American people and by the Senate when she comes forward to report these kinds of serious allegations.
Anna North is with us by phone, senior reporter at Vox, as we talk about this ever-changing story, whether Christine Blasey Ford will be testifying this Thursday before the Senate Judiciary Committee regarding her accusation against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. And then late Sunday evening, a story broke from The New Yorker that another woman has stepped forward, Deborah Ramirez, who accuses Mr. Kavanaugh of, exposing himself to her when they were students at Yale University. You can join this conversation, too. The number 860-275-7266. I understand now that our Connecticut's U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal has now joined us by phone. Senator, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Good to be with you.
We originally invited you here to talk about just the procedure leading up to whether or not Dr. Ford would be testifying. Now this story broke late Sunday evening about another accusation. Your reaction, Senator?
This nomination seems to be unraveling in real time, and these latest credible, serious allegations certainly emphasize the need for an FBI investigation, an objective, impartial investigation that respects the allegations made by these survivors and gives them an opportunity to be heard. There should be a hearing, just as there will be for Dr. Blasey Ford, accorded to Deborah Ramirez, and there should be an FBI investigation that looks into her claims, because these are really very, very disturbing, and they go to the question not only of misconduct, sexual assault, but also the credibility of this nominee.
Do you believe Brett Kavanaugh should withdraw his name?
I've called for the withdrawal of his nomination, but whether there's agreement or disagreement on that point, the real obligation now is, before any vote, in good conscience, the Senate must conduct an impartial and objective evaluation through trained professionals at the FBI.
Well, you know, there have been critiques of how both parties have handled this accusation, first from Dr. Ford, the fact that Senator Dianne Feinstein first knew about this and didn't tell her colleagues, and she says because at that point Dr. Ford wanted to remain anonymous. And I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit about, you know, these behind-the-scenes negotiations, investigations, how Senate staff have handled these women coming forward, and does that point to the necessity of having some kind of protocol in place to deal with these claims before confirmation hearings happen?
Confirmation hearings are absolutely necessary for a woman like Dr. Blasey Ford, who makes a credible allegation, and unfortunately the Republican leadership imposed arbitrary and irrational deadlines and other conditions on her testimony. She very bravely and courageously foresaw that she faced a nightmare of public shaming, false accusations, and literally threats to her safety, in fact, death threats. And yet she shared her story with the world, and she was willing to testify, but the Republican leadership in effect said and continued to say that she must yield to questioning by an outside attorney or staff member. There can be no corroborating witnesses and no FBI investigation. And I believe strongly that there needs to be outside witnesses, including Mark Judge, who is a key figure here and was involved, apparently, in the incident involving Dr. Blasey Ford. And in addition to those outside witnesses, there needs to be documents, and other kinds of evidence that may be involved available to the committee and made public. So there are conditions that the Republican leadership imposed, unacceptable to her, and yet she came more than halfway. In fact, she came very far in meeting these demands. And maybe there needs to be a protocol, but the Senate rules are what, in effect, the majority says they are. And that is a fact of life that we have to accept, or at least we live with it.
We just heard from Anna North, senior reporter at Vox, talking about some of the parallels and similarities between this situation related to Brett Kavanaugh and Anita Hill back in 1991 when she accused Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment. You'd mentioned there should be a protocol, but there are rules in place in how these issues are dealt with. But I'm just wondering, moving forward, what would you like to see?
Moving forward, very clearly, in addition to an FBI investigation, there should be additional hearings. One is scheduled for this Thursday, where Dr. Blasey Ford and Judge Kavanaugh both will testify, but no corroborating witnesses. Those witnesses, like Mark Judge, should be called to a separate hearing. In addition, Deborah Ramirez should be heard. There should be an opportunity for any of the survivors to be heard. The rush to judgment should be stopped. There's no reason for these arbitrary deadlines or timetables. And essentially, the United States Senate, having a duty to advise and consent, should seek all the facts and evidence and follow them wherever they lead.
You've mentioned the need for an FBI investigation, but who can compel the FBI to investigate? Congress doesn't have the power, but the president does?
That is absolutely right. The president has the sole power to compel an FBI investigation. He could order it right now. And the question is, what are they hiding and concealing? What are they afraid of the American people seeing or hearing as a result of that investigation? And I think it speaks volumes that they have not only failed to ask for an FBI investigation when, remember, both of these sexual assault survivors asked for it. When they say that the survivors are lying, rarely do people ask for an FBI investigation to investigate claims that they think are lies. So I think it speaks to the credibility of these two survivors that they are asking for an FBI investigation. They have come forward at great personal cost. They've offered names of witnesses to be questioned, and they have suggested other corroborating evidence. Dr. Blasey Ford, some 6 years ago, spoke to a therapist who took notes about her allegations well before the nomination went forward. And she took a polygraph, a lie detector test. So there is a lot of evidence and potential testimony that needs to be explored here, and the FBI investigation should go forward with professionals who are trained in sexual assault investigations.
Anna North is with a senior reporter at Vox. You mentioned the Me Too movement and how there is a difference that this is happening now before, instead of in 1991 when Anita Hill came before the Judiciary Committee. What does this mean in terms of the elections just around the corner, Anna, and how both parties are handling this situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think this, is shaping up to be potentially very influential in the midterm elections. And I know that both parties are likely looking to that. I mean, the Me Too movement has really been an enormous grassroots movement in America, especially among American women, but really for everyone. And, a number of people have been telling me in my reporting in the past few weeks that survivors are really watching what everyone does right now. And that includes what the Senate does, and that includes what both parties do, and those survivors will be voting in November.
Senator Blumenthal, again, you sit on the Senate Judiciary Committee, so your understanding is the hearing on Thursday is going forward as of now?
Well, unless something has changed in the last 2 hours. It will go forward. That's my understanding. There is an agreement. Senator Feinstein has asked that all proceedings be postponed. My feeling is that we're prepared to go forward. It should go forward. But the vote, very importantly, the vote on this nomination, whether in committee or on the floor of the Senate, cannot in good conscience take place before there is a full, fair FBI investigation and an opportunity for all of the sexual assault survivors to be heard.
Richard Blumenthal is Connecticut's U.S. Senator, member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator Blumenthal, thanks for calling in. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Also, Anna North, a senior reporter at Vox, who's been reporting on this case between Dr. Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh. Anna, thank you for calling in as well as a guest, and we'll be tweeting out a link to your story at Where We Live.
Thanks so much.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we're going to get an update on an ordinance set to begin October 1st in the city of Hartford that bans crisis pregnancy centers from, quote, deceptive advertising practices. Now, what spurred Hartford City Council to pass the law in the first place? More on that right after the break. And you can join the conversation, too, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. On October 1st, the city of Hartford will have a new law in effect that focuses on faith-based crisis pregnancy centers. The ordinance was expected to go into effect earlier this year, but a U.S. Supreme Court decision related to a California case had raised questions about the legality of Hartford's law. For more, we're joined now by phone Jenna Carlesso. She covers Hartford City Hall and politics for the Hartford Current. Jenna, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
First off, can you tell us more about the pregnancy centers in question when we mentioned faith-based? So what are we talking about here?
Yeah, there's one in Hartford that is sort of at the center of this whole ordinance. It's called the Hartford Women's Center. It opened in May of 2017. And almost immediately after that, some of the pro-abortion groups in Connecticut began to get a volley of complaints from people who were being intercepted by the staff there. And what that might look like is, you know, a woman shows up looking for an appointment at an abortion clinic, which is right near the Hartford Women's Center. They're approached by staff from the Women's Center and said, you know, your appointment is actually in here. And then they're taken inside and walked through some anti-abortion rhetoric.
Now, we had mentioned this was supposed to take effect, I believe, July 1st of this year, but was suspended in June because of this California law being overturned. Can you talk about that and how that relates?
Yeah, the California law required these so-called crisis pregnancy centers to not only disclose medical credentials, but to tell clients that they can access free and low-cost abortion plans. The city decided after that came out, that decision came out, to press pause and to consult with lawyers and experts in the area. And then last week they came back and said, you know, they believe that their ordinance is not as far reaching as the California law was, and that they're okay to proceed with it.
So specifically the Hartford ordinance, what does it ask these pregnancy centers to do?
So starting on October 1, the pregnancy centers would have to disclose via a sign, either in their window and in the reception area, that they either don't have a licensed medical provider on staff or on site that day. And the city also is requiring them to post it on their websites and disclose it when somebody places a call.
And what has been the response? So we have the pro-choice voice in this and also pro-life advocates. Is there going to be a suit possibly filed against Hartford to stop this?
It's possible. You know, a statewide institute, the Family Institute of Connecticut, has arranged for a lawyer to talk to the Hartford Women's Center and to decide whether they're going to bring a lawsuit.
For more context on, you know, the complaints, as Jenna mentioned, of some of these pregnancy centers, how they would go up to certain individuals and their advertising, joining the phone on the phone right now is Sarah Croucher. She's executive director of NARL Pro Choice Connecticut. Sarah, are you there?
I'm here. Good morning.
So tell us more about why this was needed in Hartford.
So at NARL, we've been tracking the activities of these centers across our state for several years now. And so we were quite aware of the kinds of deceptive tactics that they use. And most of the organizations in our state are affiliated with larger national groups. So there's kind of a standard set of tactics that they tend to use. And I should emphasize that the issue that we take is not with faith-based centers existing to counsel people, because it's absolutely something that some people want when they're faced with an unplanned pregnancy. What we are taking issue with is the fact that these centers deliberately try to deceive people when they're seeking real, legitimate medical care from licensed providers and make them think that they're at a medical facility when actually they're not. And so this case in Hartford is, I think, one of the things that's very telling is the center that now is calling itself Hartford Women's Center, their legal name is actually St. Gerard's Center for Life. They used to be located elsewhere in Hartford. And it was only when they moved in next door to Hartford GYN Center, which is in a licensed family planning clinic that provides abortions, that they started doing business as Hartford Women's Center. They changed their signage so that they look as much as they can like the clinic. And we have several reports from patients who were going to their appointment at the clinic, and as they were walking in, they were intercepted by one of the volunteers from the center, and they were told that their appointment was actually with them, and then given a lot of misinformation about their healthcare needs.
Sarah, are there other, you mentioned there's only one, I think, or Jenna had mentioned there's only one in the city of Hartford. Are there other faith-based crisis pregnancy centers around the state, and are there other issues in other communities?
Yeah, so there's 25 of these centers statewide at the moment, and that includes a van that actually sometimes comes to the city of Hartford. And they're varied in terms of what they do. So some of them are very upfront about the fact that they're faith-based centers and the kinds of services that they're offering. And others of them, on their websites in particular, say very clearly and very prominently, thinking about having an abortion, come to us. We can help. We give you all options counseling. We can do all the first stages that you need to start moving towards having an abortion. And this is entirely incorrect, because these centers exist in part, in large part, because of their opposition to abortion. And so what they actually want to do is get those people that are looking for abortion care or looking for counseling from a licensed medical provider to talk about potentially having an abortion, to get them into their centers, and then to give them misinformation. And we've had numerous undercover secret shopper visitors who have gone to these centers around the state. And what we have recorded is that they're very clear in telling people, if they ask about abortion, that they should come in for an appointment, that they'll try and kind of keep them going. And certainly here in Hartford, one of the doctors who came to testify, who was a resident at Hartford Hospital, spoke about a case where they'd had a patient who came to the emergency room at Hartford Hospital who had been going to one of these centers, we're not exactly sure which one, and they had been told to keep coming back and coming back for another ultrasound because, you know, there was some more things that they needed to clarify. And by the time they saw this doctor in the emergency room, this patient was actually past the point where they could have an abortion, despite the fact that they had been very clear about the fact that that was what they wanted. And so it's those kinds of tactics that we're very concerned about.
This is Where We Live. Today we're talking about a new ordinance going into effect in the city of Hartford in another week or so that would keep faith-based crisis pregnancy centers from engaging in deceptive advertising and requiring the staff there to display whether its staff actually carry medical licenses. Jenna Carless is joining us. She covers Hartford City Hall and politics for the Hartford Current. You just heard from Sarah Croucher, the executive director of NARL Pro-Choice Connecticut. And to get the other side to this story, Peter Wolfgang is with us, executive director of the Family Institute of Connecticut. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So if you could explain what are some of the reasons why the Family Institute of Connecticut opposes this new ordinance.
Well, first of all, because we've seen no evidence that the pro-life pregnancy centers in Connecticut deceive their clients, as is being claimed, as both Sarah and Jenna said, it's the pro-abortion groups that are getting these complaints. If this is true, why have there been no complaints made to the Attorney General? Why have there been no complaints made to the Department of Consumer Protection? And in fact, these are the questions that were asked by the Public Health Committee of our state legislature when NARAL tried to pass a similar bill that failed last year, this past year at our state legislature. They were working on two tracks. They did pass this ordinance in Hartford, but they failed to pass one at the state legislature. And the Public Health Committee, including legislators who are very liberal, very democratic, very sympathetic to NARAL's agenda, actually ended up abandoning their own bill because of the questions that they were willing to explore that the Hartford City Council wasn't. Jonathan Steinberg, who was the state rep who actually sponsored their bill, said he wasn't sure by the end of it because the definition of deceptive was so vague. And I think that's, it, to some degree, at the heart of the difference between me and Sarah. When she says, well, I think they're deceptive, I don't doubt her sincerity. I think it's rooted in some sense, and this has been true of the abortion fight for 45 years, in the different ways that we see the world. If you listen to the testimony that NARAL gave at the state legislature, you know, to them, if a pro-life center puts up a sign saying pregnant need help, that by definition is deceptive. It seems to them that any, like the mere existence of these pro-life centers is by definition deceptive. So any advertising, any speech from them because they don't provide abortion is automatically suspect. And so this was what was litigated at the U.S. Supreme Court level. And we think there's a very similar issue at play here, where the pro-abortion side seems to deny the right of free speech to pro-lifers, as if there's this pro-life exemption to the First Amendment. The U.S. Supreme Court said that's not so. We think the same issues are at play here with both this ordinance in Hartford and also the statewide thing that they try to pass every year at the state legislature. And so that's why we think we've seen no evidence of deception. In fact, at the state legislature, again, even legislators who are sympathetic to them pointed out, you know, all the evidence for this is coming out of the activist group, out of NARAL, and it's all second or third person. It's all hearsay. A lot of it is their own agents. They haven't produced any people who gave firsthand accounts of these things that they're alleging, and there's been no complaints to the proper state agencies that this was true. And actually, I mean, these groups have been targeting the pro-life centers since before the center went up in Hartford. They issued some report about 3 years ago. So this has been an ongoing campaign, part of a national campaign against the pro-life centers. And it looks to us like they're being targeted in part because the rate of abortion is declining nationally, and even here in Connecticut, it used to be 15,000 a year. It's down to about 10,000 a year. And it looks to us like the pro-abortion side wants to use the heavy hand of government to take out the competition. And in Hartford, the municipal government is only too happy to help.
I wanted to go back to Sarah Croucher. Sarah, unfortunately, we lost your call while Peter Wolfgang was talking about why they are against this ordinance. But if you could talk a little bit more about some of their concerns, that they feel that this is really just a tactic coming from the pro-choice side, and that there weren't really any complaints about the center afforded to agencies that are responsible for looking into it, like the Department of Consumer Protection.
Yeah, so there's a couple of points to that. One, I want to speak to that falling rate of abortions, which is a wonderful thing. And, of course, we are pleased about that. And the biggest reason behind that, it ties in very closely to policy changes that have given people better access to contraceptive coverage, especially around the Affordable Care Act, where people can access contraceptive coverage with no copays. We work closely with our allies in the Connecticut Coalition for Choice to pass a bill last year that protects that coverage in our state statutes now, whatever happens in D.C. And so in our work as a pro-choice organization, as opposed to a pro-abortion organization, which Peter Wolfgang wants to call us, we want to make sure that people have access to the healthcare that they need, that they choose. And as I said before, that includes the fact that if people want to go and seek religious counseling, they absolutely should go and do that. But what is really important is that individuals, when they're seeking some kind of care, know what kind of care it is that they're getting. And our concern with these centers is the fact that they set themselves up to look like medical centers when they're not. So some, many of these centers nationwide, for instance, the kinds of tactics we see is they have fake HIPAA forms. They get people to give over personal information when they're not covered by any kinds of real privacy protections. They have people dressed in scrubs or white coats as though they're medical providers when they're not. And for patients who think they're getting medical care, this is obviously something that's deeply disturbing around the kind of deceptive factors. And then the other thing that I want to go back and speak to there is also about the fact that in terms of complaints, it's very difficult to have patients who are seeking an abortion, something that's often still quite stigmatized in our society, and then who often manage to go to a real clinic and get that abortion to come forward and make complaints. So the stories, the direct stories that we have come from patients who are in the waiting room of the clinic, who are happy to share their story about what happened with them on an anonymous basis, but absolutely did not want to come forward personally and testify. And there are obviously good reasons for this, because someone doesn't want to stand up and make a public complaint saying, I got an abortion, but this is what happened to me on my route to make it to getting that abortion. Or even worse, for someone to say, well, I had this child, but actually I was trying to have an abortion and these people blocked me from getting an abortion that I wanted to have. And so this is something where we think we really need to address the deceptive practices themselves. The timeline around the state bill was certainly one where state legislators had questions as the Supreme Court case was pending, and those have been worked through. And we know that there's been a lot of legal work done by on the Hartford side to look at the language of this ordinance. And it's based on two different pieces of ordinances that have been upheld in federal court that are not being challenged in the Supreme Court, one from San Francisco and one a piece of an ordinance that was partly struck down but partially upheld in New York. We took the piece that was partially upheld. So this has a really sound legal basis for addressing these centers and what they do.
I want to take a listener call. Susan's calling from Hartford. Susan, go ahead.
Hello. I just wanted to say that it is not credible to think that a woman walking into a crisis pregnancy center would lose much more than 5 minutes of time in then leaving and obtaining an abortion if that's what she chose. So this ordinance is not motivated by an actual problem that exists in Hartford, but a larger scale agenda. Because if you look at this ordinance, it is basically a template of similar ordinances in cities all over the United States. But the good news is that ultimately when these ordinances have been taken to court, when the cities have been taken to court and they wind through the federal courts after spending hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases, they are struck down because it's against the Constitution.
Well, Susan, thank you. So, thank you for your call. I just wanted to have Sarah respond to you.
So as we said, this is based on two pieces of ordinances that have been both upheld in federal court. The core of it comes from a San Francisco ordinance that the Supreme Court have declined to take up the case beyond where it's been litigated in federal court. It's been upheld. And again, as I said, part of it, the signage part, comes from a part of a New York ordinance, which has also been upheld in our same federal district court. So we feel very confident about the legal structure of this. And also on the time taken, I mean, I would refer back to the testimony that I referred to from a doctor in Hartford about a woman here in the city who had been blocked from receiving an abortion that she was looking for. So this doesn't just come from us. This also comes from medical providers.
I want to go back to Peter Wolfgang, Executive Director of the Family Institute of Connecticut. Peter, we had mentioned earlier, we heard from Jenna, that you may be considering litigation to stop this ordinance. So what are your plans?
Well, that is up to the attorney. You know, I know they're considering their options. What they end up deciding to do, I don't know yet. But, you know, the Attorney General and the Consumer Protection Departments, they do have processes for whistleblowers. I mean, it is possible to go to them with confidential stuff. So it still looks to us like, number one, that this is phony, that they're only going to these abortion activist groups and they're not going to the state agencies. And number two, I'd say in response to what Sarah said to the caller, you know, Hartford has been very poorly served by just taking the advice of the pro-abortion side at face value. when they had their first hearing on this ordinance on November 20th, the Hartford City Council seemed unaware that there was a U.S. Supreme Court case pending, and we warned them that they could be sued. Right now, Baltimore has had to pay about $1.1 million to the pro-life side for trying to pass a statute like this. And the NARAL side said, oh, there's nothing to worry about here. And the original statute was supposed to go into effect immediately. So, you know, because of our threats of a lawsuit, because of the things they didn't learn about from the folks they were listening to, by December 11th, when they passed this, they changed the effective date until July so that they could wait to see what the Supreme Court would decide. And even then, the lawyers on the other side said, oh, there's nothing to worry about, go ahead. And then it shook out exactly the way we said it would. On June 26th, the pro-life side won at the U.S. Supreme Court, and Hartford was forced to suspend that ordinance. Now they say the ordinance will go into effect on October 1st. They've not been served well by not listening to the other side, and I think it's quite possible that a city that has threatened bankruptcy very recently, that has all these problems, could end up having to pay a lot of money to a pro-life center over an unnecessary fight.
Peter, thank you again for calling in. I wanted to go back to reporter Jenna Carlesso with the Hartford Current. So October 1st, as we know, the ordinance is set to start. Who's going to be in charge of enforcing this?
The city's Health and Human Services Department will be doing enforcement. You know, that could be anything from walking by the crisis pregnancy center to see if a sign is posted in the window to placing a call. And if they are found in violation, the city is able to levy fines of up to or around $100 a day.
Jenna Carlesso, again, covers Hartford City Hall and politics for The Current. Jenna, thanks for calling in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Also, you heard from Sarah Croucher, Executive Director of NARL Pro-Choice Connecticut, and Peter Wolfgang, Executive Director of the Family Institute of Connecticut. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Coming up, mystery has long surrounded Plum Island, which for years has been home to a high-security animal disease center. The lab's moving to Kansas, so the federal government wants to sell Plum Island. But is that the best option made up of this island, made up of more than 800 acres? An author and historian from Long Island will join us after the break. You can too, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. For decades, Plum Island has been home to a federal animal disease center. Now, Congress voted 10 years ago to sell the island once operations moved to a new Kansas facility. But residents in both Connecticut and Long Island opposed the sale of public land to a private bidder. And some environmentalists worry a potential sale would adversely affect the habitat of some endangered species. Now, for more on the history of Plum Island, Amy Folk joins us. She's historian for the town of Southold, New York, and co-author of the book about Plum Island called A World Unto Itself. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit more about Plum Island. Many of us have heard about it. Most of us have never been there. Why is it called Plum Island?
It's called Plum Island because we believe that in 1656, the Dutch explorers, when they came through, they called it Plum Island. And we think it might have come from the beach plums that were growing all over the area.
And when we think about how it was first used, who occupied this island and what was it used for?
Well, the island for many, many years was never occupied. It was used by the local Native Americans as an island to plant corn. In fact, they called it Mantawantanag, which was island we plant corn on. So we only really know about it in the 1600s from the European settlers' descriptions of it.
Now, we're talking with you because technically Plum Island is part of Southold, New York?
It is. It is. Actually, Southold's jurisdiction runs all the way up to the edge of Connecticut to Fisher's Island. But originally, Southold got jurisdiction of the island in 1676.
And when did the federal government move in?
The federal government didn't move in until 1898, which was the Spanish-American War. So before that, it was actually private, and it was owned by many different farmers over the years.
And so there's actually a fort still there?
There's the remains of a fort still there. The fort was called Fort Terry, and it was built for the Spanish-American War. We were really worried in our area, the Connecticut shoreline as well as Manhattan, that Spain, which had the greatest armada in the world at the time, was going to sail their boats in and blow us all up because we had picked a fight with them. So the government decided that they would build a string of forts that went all the way from Camp Hero in Montauk and kind of strung its way across the islands all the way up to Wachill, Connecticut.
And then after World War II, new plans for Plum Island. What made the federal government think this would be a good place for virus research?
Well, in 1948, they had planned a research lab in Camp Hero near Montauk, and local legislation had been, introduced, I think, on the federal level that said you cannot have a research lab that can be close or connected to the mainland by any bridge, tunnel, or other connections. At that same time, they had already announced that they were going to sell the island, and the County Board of Supervisors in Suffolk County offered to buy it as a recreation center, but GSA said that they would sell it for educational purposes. So everybody agreed, and by 1950, there were outside offers being given to Suffolk County. It looked like they were starting to consider some of these offers for golf courses and condominiums and things like that. So GSA froze the bidding process. And then we went right into the Korean War, so all bids were canceled. And since the island was not connected by any bridge, mainland, or tunnel, they said, well, this is a perfect place to put our research area.
Amy Folks, historian for the town of Southold, New York, co-author of the book A World Unto Itself. We're talking with Amy to learn more about the mysterious Plum Island. Tell us more about the research that's been conducted there on the island.
Well, I'm not a veterinarian, so I'm really not an expert on it. However, the research that has been there is mostly to study foot and mouth disease, as well as things like rhinovirus, and let me see, I have a list here somewhere. Foot and mouth disease, rhinovirus, African swine fever, diseases that affect farm animals, not diseases that affect humans.
Mm. There's a lot of mystery surrounding Plum Island because it's not really open to visitors because of this Federal Animal Disease Center. And you did make a point that what was studied there is diseases that don't transmit to humans. But some of the conspiracies over the years, of course, you know this, Amy, about Lyme disease possibly originating there.
Yeah, you know, and that's kind of curious because Lyme disease is first described as existing in 1764 in Scotland. So probably the settlers brought it with them over to the New World. Lyme disease has been in the world for a really long time, and the fact that ticks picked it up and spread it is just one of the ways that it spreads across the country. So.
And I mentioned how most of us are able to go to Plum Island. Have you been there?
Yeah, I've been there several times.
And what is it like?
It is a vast, uncharted wilderness. It is mostly the ruins of the fort. There's just one little section closest to Southold that is actually used. It is a wonderful place for animals to roam and plants to grow because no one disturbs them. It's kind of odd when you walk in the labs, because I live in Southold, I see a lot of people that I know. So as I go down the hallways, it's like, oh, I know you from Cub Scouts. Oh, I know you from grocery store. Oh, I know you from, you know, my kid's school. So there's a lot of people that you don't realize that work on the island that are your neighbors and friends.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that it's a perfect place for certain animals. This is what environmentalists are saying, that there's good habitat there for endangered species, and they worry that a sale would hurt these habitats. You know, Southold, New York, surprised that this has languished for about 10 years now?
I don't know if we're surprised. You know, everything that is with the government moves very slowly. I don't know if we're necessarily surprised how long it's taking for this to go through or not go through. It is a wonderful place, and it is what Long Island used to look like, and probably what Connecticut used to look like at one point. Long Island has, for the most part, become a large extension of New York City. So a lot of our farmlands all were bought up and built upon just after World War II. So Plum Island is probably one of the last places that's truly wild in what our area used to look like, and what your area used to look like, too, in Connecticut.
You were talking about some of the people who actually work at Plum Island. At one point, they actually lived there, didn't they?
Yeah, when the island was originally set up to be labs, the Army, of course, when the Army was there, they, of course, lived on the island. And when the labs were set up, originally the scientists and their families all moved there, and Southold had school teachers that would go over and live on the island to teach the children. Eventually, they decided that was it was too difficult, so the school kids started to commute back and forth between Plum Island and the Orient schools, and the kids would come across on the ferry every day. I guess the isolation of the island, because there's no grocery stores, there's no movie theaters, there's no restaurants or anything like that, started to get to people. So the scientists, I guess, as a group, decided that they were actually going to live either in Southold or in Connecticut, and they would commute to the island every day.
We'd mentioned the talk about the sale has been going on now for 10 years. So technically, the Animal Disease Center, there's still work being done on Plum Island?
Yeah. And I think they're slowly starting to move some of their operations out west into Kansas.
And when you talk to other residents in Southold, New York, what would they like to see happen with Plum Island versus the government just selling to the highest bidder?
Well, everybody here pretty much wants to keep it as a conservation area. We're not interested in having it built upon. Not only because a lot of people are environmentally conscious out here, but also because our roads can't handle the traffic. There is literally two roads that run east-west, and that's only to Greenport. So there's only one road that runs out to the point where people would have to catch the ferry to go over to it. And we really just can't handle the traffic anymore.
I understand that there is even changes in zoning to prevent this island from being built up, say, if it were to be sold to a private developer.
Yeah. The town has taken proactive stance on this, which is wonderful.
And you mentioned the history with Fort Terry, but there's also a lighthouse there?
Yeah, there is. There is. The original lighthouse was built in the 1820s, and it was so poorly built it started to fall apart by 1840. And so the lighthouse that you see there now was built in 1869. It is a wonderful example of Gothic Victorian kind of architecture. It is a historic building, certainly. Unfortunately, it's starting to deteriorate, well, a little more than starting to deteriorate, and the Historic Preservation Committee of Southold is strongly urging Southold Town, as well as the federal government, to step in and try and at least stabilize the building. The upper section of the building is built out of cast metal, so it is rusting away at a tremendous rate from the salt air. So we're hoping it will be stabilized. It is the only lighthouse in our town that's still owned by the federal government. We have 8 lighthouses in our town, and they're all private hands except for the Plum Island one. Mm.
I'd mentioned earlier a coalition of environmental groups had sued the federal government to try to halt the sale for several reasons, and our friends over at the Connecticut Mirror reported that the GSA, the General Services Administration, is actually going to conduct a new environmental impact study on the proposed sale of Plum Island. So it sounds like for now the island will remain as is, and we'll have to find out more in the weeks and months ahead. But I want to thank Amy Folk, historian for the town of Southold, New York, and co-author of the book A World Unto Itself, for helping us demystify Plum Island. We appreciate your time, Amy.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for asking.
Today's show, produced by senior producer Lydia Brown. Thanks to Kerman Baskoff. Our technical producer is Kyone Wolf. Learn more about the show, wmpr.org/where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.